I like to have art that I collect, artists around me who've been dead for 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 years, but I make an exception for Australian toneless painting. It's influential, it's significant, and yet largely neglected. Max Meldrum is one of my very favourite painters. There are two wonderful Meldrums in the ANG, although sometimes they don't hang my favourite and I keep having to grizzle about it. He was the champion of the movement and also probably the only Australian artist to develop a fully formulated theory of painting and to practice it and teach it. His proposal was that, quote, all great art is a return to nature. Art is religion. The universe is its cathedral, and its creed is the humble and sublime one of all true artists and natural scientists whose faith is based on demonstrable, visible, or audible facts. I have to tell you, I've got a tiny little Meldrum at home, which I adore. It's a treescape. And he seemed to have painted it at just about midnight. You've got to really stare at it. In fact, it almost helps to get a torch. Meldrum was, he drove other artists really bonkers. They got really cranky with him. Lionel Lindsay used to describe Meldrum as the Mad Mullah. And Norman Lindsay gave him a rough trot in his novel A Curate in Bohemia, where is the basis for the character, the dogmatic McQuibble. Anyway, he's with us again, a travelling exhibition called Misty Moderns, Australian Toneless, 1915 to 1950. He's currently showing at that exquisite art gallery of South Australia, and it's the first major exhibition to tell the story of Australian tonalism and of Meldrum and of a fascinating woman called Clarice Beckett. Its curator, Tracy Locke Weir, joins us. She's the curator of Australian paintings and sculpture at the gallery, and she's on the Dog and Bone from the Athens of the South. Joining us as well is Rosalind Hollenrake, who's a writer, a curator, and an expert on one of Meldrum's followers and pupils, the aforementioned Clarice Beckett. And Rosalind's in our Melbourne TARDIS. In fact, Rosalind's done much more than that. Almost single-handedly, she's put Clarice back on the pedestal she so thoroughly deserves. Tracy, for listeners who haven't seen any toneless paintings, and they're all, you know, they're all staring at their radios, can you evoke them for us?
Yeah, of course. Look, they have quite a unifying and distinctive characteristic in the way that they appear very soft and very atmospheric. So the information within the paintings is not sharply defined like a photograph. The information is very softly rendered, so the tone.
You can say that again sometimes. Well, someone has described the paintings as looking they've been painted with cotton wool instead of brushes.
Yes, that's right. And sometimes people have described looking at them as though they've got Vaseline on the lens of their camera. So that kind of very soft effect is how you can really identify a tonalist painting.
And I understand that it was one of the beliefs of the sainted Max that it was a good idea to stand back a fair distance.
Well, that's right. They have been painted in accordance to Meldrum's methodology, and that involves standing back about 6 metres from the painting. And that's because from that distance, if you fix or hold your gaze on the subject, you just need to allow a little bit of time for the planes within the picture to shift, just gently shift and come into sort of focus. And from that distance, the work, you can get a wonderful sense of spatial penetration and three-dimensional effect within it. And that's based on the way that they were painted, is to create that effect from a distance.
I mentioned that my little Meldrum is incredibly sort of fuzzy and dark, but there's that wonderful painting of a barn, or is it a peasant's cottage, on the walls of the ANG in Canberra, which I think is in your exhibition.
Yes, look, there is Pichere's farm, which
that's
is
the one. Yeah.
In the exhibition. It's one of 3 early French subjects by Meldrum that I've included, which really best demonstrate the strong influence that the French Barbizon landscape painter Corot had on Meldrum while he was he was living in France for a period of 12 years, and it has that lovely, almost luminous, glowing effect, and very strong shadows and so forth, but it just sort of leaps out from the depths of darkness.
Before we bring Rosalind in, I'd just like to give people a feeling for Meldrum in his ideological certainties and his rejection of modern art, and I quote, as a pathological symptom of the disease condition of modern civilization.
Mm.
He didn't hide his opinions under a bushel, did he?
No.
They weren't fuzzy.
No, he was very, very clear with his ideas, and, you know, he's really said to have been able to sort of pound his opposition into a pulp, you know, verbally. He was crushing with his words. Very, very powerful and very clear with his ideas.
I'm involved with Montsalvat, which, of course, was established by one of his enemies, Justus Jorgensen.
Yes.
And there's a story that I remember Jorgensen telling me, that Meldrum fell in the Yarra once whilst teaching his acolytes, and Jorgensen wondered why he didn't walk on the water. Rosalind Hollenrake, tell us about Clarus Beckett. What was her background? And let it be said that she is one of the best painters this country's ever produced.
Yes, I tend to agree with you there, Philip. Well, she came from a very privileged background. She wanted to paint desperately in her late teens, but while her mother was encouraging, her father was dead against it. They were very possessive parents. Eventually, at the age of 27, which is young nowadays, but then wasn't, she'd refused to marry. Every suitor that had turned up, she'd turned down. And eventually they agreed that she could go to the National Gallery School of Victoria.
She studied under McCubbin, didn't she?
For 1 year, yes.
And then,
it was 3 years, actually.
But then she got very excited, perhaps overexcited, by Max.
Well, not overexcited, but she got excited by the theories rather than Max. She liked the idea, she liked the clarity. I think most of the painters at the National Gallery School, they felt they were stifled. They were very tired of the old traditional classical rendering, and there was not a great deal of excitement, whereas Max certainly had a lot of opinions and a lot of very clever ideas, and he got people to look, you know.
She certainly looked, and she did a lot of her looking around Beaumaris, which is an old beach suburb of Melbourne. The amount of art, the amount of wonderful imagery she got out of a comparatively small piece of real estate was remarkable.
Yes, it was a gold mine to her all along the coast. That's where she lived. And, of course, she's always been, I mean, while she trained with Meldrum, but only for 1 year, she's always been called a Meldrumite. She certainly showed with him, with his student shows, from 1919 to 1921. But most of those students then went abroad, including Meldrum. And she was actually working around Beaumaris and in the city on her own for years. And it was only when Meldrum came back in 1931 and he saw her work and he said, "I wish to open your show."
Yeah.
Which in one way was an honour, but in another way, according to her sister, she actually didn't want him to, because she'd been struggling with the critics who were anti-Meldrum for the last 7 or 8 years. She'd been showing yearly, probably, I think, more shows than any other Australian artist. At the Athenaeum Theatre, she would hang 60 to 80 works, believe it or not, every year.
Which makes it all the more astonishing that she sort of vanished from memory. And then you come along, you find a little canvas sign, C. Beckett, and you go searching. And lo and behold, and this is a great story, your investigations lead you to an open-sided barn in the Victorian countryside, and what did you find therein?
Well, I couldn't tell you how many thousand of paintings, there were thousands, dirt floor, four poles, corrugated iron roof, completely open to the elements, rats, possum poo, a lot. Many of them just matted little fragments of canvas.
Oh, dear.
With the tiny touches of paint on them. But the sister and I, between us, managed to rescue a few. They'd been left up there. There was nobody wanted them.
Well, not only did nobody want them, but I believe her father burnt a lot of them.
Well, he burnt all the later works, which were apparently a big change in direction. There's one in the ANG called Sandringham Beach, which shows the way she was going. Extremely, extremely modern. And, in fact, the Adelaide Gallery also has Hawthorne Tea Gardens, which is very interesting painting. The tea gardens as they were on the river, but it's very much into... It's not abstract because there's a man mowing on the lawn, but the actual construction of the painting's fascinating. It's really a lot of patterns, quite different from Milgram. In fact, she was totally different from a lot of the Milgram painters.
Well, she was much more of a colourist, I would have thought, than Max.
Well, she had a higher tonal palette, certainly. The others worked more with the ochre dark tones.
Yeah.
And she was more, even more impressionistic, almost. She used so little paint that it looked as though she'd breathed on the canvas rather than even applied it with cotton wool. She had that ability to put down what she saw so quickly, and she knew exactly when to stop, which was very much to do with the Milgram concept.
Tracy, you've heard Rosalind talk about her Beckett's difficult relationship with Milgram. You talk about this quite a lot, don't you? You characterise his personality as so confrontational that it wasn't just the other artists who found him difficult; it was also his students.
Oh well, that's absolutely right, and he really was polarising with his ideas, but. The fascinating thing was that he kept, as any theorist, he kept evolving his ideas as he moved along. And so his own students, were always trying to please him and always seeking his praise. Yet it's interesting because I believe from Rosalind that the only student that sort of ever came through his studio that he ever praised was, in fact, was the work of Clarice Beckett, which set up a whole series of ramifications for her. But they were always seeking his praise, and he would never compliment their work. He would always set the bar even higher and higher and then change his ideas. So he, in himself, is very, very interesting in terms of his character, full of contradictions and full of ironies. And I mean, the fact that he was only a tiny, tiny man, only 5 foot tall, but his personality was enormous. And the fact that he painted pictures that looked incredibly conservative, but were based on very progressive theoretical ideas.
He did quite well towards the end of his career. He became a member of the establishment that he, in a sense, derided because he's appointed a trustee of the National Gallery of Victoria. He wins the Archibald twice, does he not?
Mm. Yeah, but controversy was never far from him, even, you know, right up until the end. And he was regarded as the stormy petrel of the Australian art world. But I think in the end, you know, he was certainly achieving some degree of, acceptance by the establishment after he'd sort of mown them down the years before that. But, look, once he passed away in about 1955, there was two retrospectives staged. One in the most recent was in 1961, and that retrospective travelled to was held in Brisbane and Sydney and Melbourne. But, you know, the thing is that nothing has occurred since then. And he's really, look, to be honest, even today when I talk to colleagues in state, some of them still bristle at the mention of his name. I think that's so fascinating that even to this day...
I think that's to his credit. I like that sort of response. And Rosalind, these days, of course, when you mention the name of Miss Beckett, people purr.
Not all of them. Don't be fooled, Philip. No, it was very interesting. I had the same problem as Tracy earlier the National Gallery Brown Finnemore, who, when I first put on the Beckett exhibition, came in and said, I won't put it as crudely as he did, but he wondered what in the hell I was raising this Meldrum stuff for.
Is that right?
Dear old Alan McCulloch, the Herald critic.
Yes, I remember Alan well.
When I first went to see Alan to see if he'd ever heard of C. Beckett, now he was putting together the
History of Australian Art.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he just said to me very grumpily, no, never heard the name. And I said, but you must be past the bees. And you haven't got anything? And he said, no, nothing. And then when he came in to see the exhibition and he was very, very cross with me. I mean, we were good friends, but he did apologise years later, but he just said, you don't understand how we actually hated the man.
Dear, oh dear. Rosalind, how many works of C. Beckett survive? All the vicissitudes and disasters you have described. How many paintings are known to be around?
I can't give you an accurate figure. We're probably up to about 800. I'm still working on a catalogue raisonné, which I've been doing for over 35 years, because occasionally one turns up. Just very, very occasionally now. But just going back to Meldrum, in his defence, his students did love him, even though he was difficult. They loved him very deeply. I found when Colin Coulihan in Italy was still passionate about him, though they'd fallen out, I found John Farmer passionate, weeping as an old man. We did love Mr. Meldrum. So it's very interesting, and I've got just this lovely little thing about his sarcasm. When a critic wrote, Mr. Meldrum cannot paint, only witness his paintings of gum trees looking like horses' hooves resting on the ground, Meldrum replied by writing an article to the paper, congratulating the critic who had managed to see in his picture what he'd failed to see in nature. I think it's so beautiful.
And on that uplifting note, I've got to take my leave of you. Dear ladies, I've been talking to Tracy Lockweir, curator of Australian art at the Art Gallery of South Australia, the curator of the exhibition Misty Moderns, Take a Torch When You Visit, and to Rosalind Honenrake, writer, curator and expert on the beautiful paintings of Clarice Beckett. Misty Moderns is on at the Art Gallery of South Australia until next Sunday, the 19th of October, so rush in. It will travel. It will be sent at various galleries around the country next year, and details are on our website at www.abc.net.au/rn. On our next Classic LNL, as I think I might have mentioned earlier, two interviews from the depth of the vault, both on the themes of feminism. We've got a Liberal Party founding member, Dame Beryl Beaurepaire, and the other with GG. No, not with the Governor-General, but with Germaine Greer. And next week I'll be talking to the biographer of that most extraordinary of capitalists, Warren Buffett. Thanks to the team, Chris Short, Paul Goff, Sarah Konofsky, Sasha Fegan, Kate McDonald, Chris Bullock, and, of course, good old Horace. Stick around now for the news, and we'll talk to you later on. Thank you.
listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.